My name is Michael McCusker. February is Black History Month. It might be pertinent to mention that the American slave trades began 400 and more years ago in 1619, and that a prominent Virginia slave owner, George Washington, was elected the first president of the USA on February 3rd, 1789. And also that Rosa Parks, who was born February 4th, 1913, received the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest civilian honor in the U.S. And on June 15th, 1999, she was venerated as the mother of the civil rights movement, quote unquote, for refusing to give up her seat on a Montgomery, Alabama bus to a white man. Virulent white supremacy racism that never ceases to stigmatize Black Americans as former chattel, undeserving of full and equal citizenship, makes it necessary for their recognition as equals in all things Americana. Carter Woodson, a Black scholar and educator, who was a major inspiration for Black History Month more than a century ago, articulated the need for such acknowledgement. Quote, if a race has no history, it has no worthwhile tradition in the thought of the world, and it stands in danger of being exterminated, unquote. And now, something I wrote and have read on this program before, a punch in the nose, with a quote by Walt Kelly, the author and cartoonist of Pogo, having lost our way, we are redoubling our efforts. And Joel Stein from the LA Times, when the empowered convince themselves that they are under attack, they often convince themselves that cruelty to the powerless is justified. And along those lines, an article by Dana R. Fisher. Resistance to Trump 2.0 is getting more confrontational. With a bit of a subhead. In Trump's first term, activists focused on lobbying and voting. Now tactics are shifting to nonviolent civil disobedience. On 24 January, August Pretty was killed by federal agents while he was helping another civilian in Minneapolis who had been knocked to the ground, just weeks after an ICE agent killed Renee Good. In response to this second killing of a Minnesotan, demonstrations spread across the United States to protest the Trump administration and its ultra-violent immigration enforcement tactics. Minneapolis has been in a state of sustained protest. Its general strike on 23 January mobilized tens of thousands of Minnesotans to participate in an economic blackout and march in the streets. Strikes and marches also took place across the country, including the Free America Walkout, which involved more than 900 local actions across all 50 states on the anniversary of Donald Trump's second inauguration. As part of a long-term steadying protest in America, which included documenting the resistance to the first Trump administration in my book, American Resistance, I have been studying Resistance 2.0. The project aims to understand who is participating, what is motivating people to join this second wave of resistance, and the tactics being used by activists to protest the second Trump administration and its policies. Resistance to the first Trump administration was laser focused on converting outrage-motivated resistance in the streets into action at the ballot box. Throughout those 4 years, activists focused most of their efforts on bringing about social change through formal political tactics, such as lobbying, legally permitted rallies, and voting. Evidence shows that it worked. The 2018 midterm election returned a Democratic majority to the House of Representatives, and then Joe Biden was elected the 46th President of the United States in the 2020 election, which had the highest turnout in over a century. But this time, it is different. During the first year of the second Trump administration, we once again saw some of the largest protests in United States history, though the protests were much more geographically distributed than during the first Trump administration. Although large-scale and legally permitted demonstrations continue to be scheduled, Resistance 2.0 has become more confrontational. Acts of nonviolent civil disobedience, such as blocking streets, following, recording, and observing federal agents, and participating in general strikes and walkouts, have become much more common, and this is only the beginning. Working with the organizers of the Free America Walkout, which involved participants walking out of work, school, and commerce for 2 hours during the afternoon of 20 January, my team and I surveyed 7,452 people who had signed up to participate from all across the United States, about 15% of all the registered participants. Our data provide clear evidence that Resistance 2.0 will continue to get more confrontational. An overwhelming majority of respondents to our survey, 99%, reported that they support organizations engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience, including sit-ins and blockades. Moreover, when we asked participants about the degree to which they support the movement taking more confrontational actions against the Trump administration and its policies, and if they personally would be willing to join such actions, the results were unequivocal. 79% agreed that they, quote, support social movements taking more confrontational action against the Trump administration, unquote. And 65% agreed that they would, quote, participate in more confrontational action against the Trump administration if they had the opportunity, unquote. While criticism of the shift to more confrontational with nonviolent actions comes from across the political spectrum, including from mainstream Democrats, the expansion of what social movements scholars call the repertoire of contention, quote unquote, is consistent with numerous successful social movements in U.S. history. In the early 1900s, for example, women involved in the American movement for suffrage started expanding their tactics as they realized that, quote, sometimes being polite just does not work, unquote. The movement turned to occupying public spaces and even burning an effigy of then-President Woodrow Wilson before women in the United States finally earned the right to vote in 1920. Similarly, activists from the civil rights movement shifted their strategy after realizing that they did not have the necessary access to power to make change through legal and political systems in the U.S. Instead, they employed more disruptive tactics, including staging sit-ins and coordinating non-permitted marches. Thanks in part to the diversity of tactics employed and groups involved, the Civil Rights Act was signed into law in 1964, and the Voting Rights Act became law in 1965. While civil rights movement leaders trained activists in nonviolent civil disobedience, they were acutely aware that even nonviolent civil disobedience was likely to face a violent response from law enforcement and counter movements. However, rather than cowering in fear, civil rights activists leaned into the violence against them, intentionally organizing actions in segregated areas that were likely to provoke a brutal response. As a result, many activists got arrested and filled the jails, and others were murdered. In recent weeks, we have seen similar patterns of violence against peaceful protesters in Minneapolis. An unintended side effect of these horrible acts of violence is that they generate substantial public attention and support for protesters, which can be a useful tool for expanding the movement. Tragic events present opportunities for the broader resistance to grow and evolve. The fact that Resistance 2.0 is expanding its tactics gives me hope. Americans are finding their voices and their power to push back against burgeoning autocracy. We are also seeing activists building solidarity with friends and neighbors along the way. The expansion of tactics and evolution of thinking about how citizens can push back against government violence and anti-democratic suppression is a step in the right direction. It is a sign that the people are mobilizing and working together to save America. This moment of resistance to the Trump regime opens up a window of opportunity for social change. Achieving that change will require every one of us participating in actions for justice and equity that may take us out of our comfort zone and stretch us in ways that help preserve democracy. As unfair as it may seem, neither a charismatic leader nor the Democratic Party is ready to be the change we need. We are going to have to work together to save ourselves. And that was Resistance to Trump 2.0 is Getting More Confrontational by Dana R. Fisher, who is a professor in the School of International Service at American University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She is the author of Saving Ourselves, 2024, and American Resistance, 2019. And now, America has reached a tipping point on fascism and opposition to it, by Robert Reich. A chance encounter reminded me there are two ways to look at what has happened in Minneapolis. One of the few advantages of being as conspicuous as I am is that many people come up to me whom I don't know to talk about what's happening in America. It's like a free-floating focus group. One Monday morning, I was at a restaurant counter finishing my breakfast when a middle-aged man sat down next to me and said he did not want to intrude. He just had. So I put down my knife and fork, wiped my mouth with my napkin, and turned toward him. He wanted me to know that although he had been a lifelong Republican, the events of the past weeks had caused him to leave the Republican Party. "I'm happy to hear that," I said with a smile, and turned to finish my breakfast. "I'm from New Hampshire, and many of my Republican friends are leaving the party too," he said. "Minneapolis was the last straw." I put down my fork and turned toward him again. "I assume you're talking about the behavior of ICE and Border Patrol agents there and the killings." "All terrible, of course," he said, shaking his head. "But what really finished me were the lies. Noam, Miller, Bovino, Vance, Trump." He frowned. "They lied through their teeth. I saw the videos. I can't trust them ever again. None of them. A pack of liars." I agreed and then excused myself, explaining I had to finish my breakfast and get to an appointment. but his words stuck with me. There are two ways to look at what is happening in Minneapolis, two different tipping points for America. The first is to see the nation tipping more deeply into Trump's fascist police state. ICE and the Border Patrol have become vehicles of state terror. They are engaged in extrajudicial killings with apparent impunity. The tipping point began with Trump's purging of federal prosecutors who tried to hold him accountable for his attempted coup. It continued with his pardons of the January 6th rioters, pardons of his allies and wealthy friends, his criminal prosecutions of James Comey and Letitia James, and the criminal investigation of Jerome Powell. With the Trump regime's occupation of Minneapolis by inadequately trained, trigger-happy goons with rifles and in riot gear who have bullied, beaten, and killed residents, and the regime's impending of a state investigation into the killings, its wildly false accusations about the victims, and its claim, since walked back, that federal agents responsible for the killings have total immunity from prosecution. But there is a second way to see what has happened in Minnesota, a tipping point of a different kind. The fellow from New Hampshire who sat next to me at breakfast typifies it. It is a tipping point toward mass revulsion over Trump and the people around him. To be sure, the Republican Party in America has been in a death spiral since Trump emerged in 2016. It's held together chiefly by Trump's lies, but his latest lies and those of his surroundings, sycophants, are so blatant and disgusting that some, like my breakfast companion, are abandoning the GOP altogether. It is also a tipping point toward Americans coming together to defeat Trump's fascism, coming together as they have come together in Minneapolis, across race, class, and ethnicity. I hear from friends and former students in Minneapolis about the extraordinary outpouring there of cooperation and mutual aid, residents participating in neighborhood watches, messaging about where agents are lurking, taking videos of ICE's atrocities and sharing them widely. They are organizing deliveries of food and other necessities to families afraid to leave their homes, picking up groceries for immigrant families, standing guard outside a local mosque during Friday prayers, driving vulnerable families to doctor's appointments, driving immigrant kids to school. One friend tells me he has lived in Minneapolis for 40 years and has never felt the city as closely bound together. "I think we have discovered the real meaning of community," he wrote. A former student says that despite the sub-zero weather, he and everyone he knows have been involved in organizing against ICE and for one another. This goes far deeper than a protest, he says. It is a new way to live here. This is not limited to Minneapolis. I am hearing from friends and former students across America who are seeing something similar where they live. "You wouldn't believe how this community has come together," writes an old friend from Portland, Maine. "I have lived here for more than 20 years, and I do not recall a time when we felt as united," quote unquote. Both tipping points may be true. We're tipping into Trump's fascist police state at the same time as we are tipping into a new era of solidarity. The second may be the consequence of the first. All I can say with any confidence is that the events of the last weeks are changing America profoundly. What comes next? I don't buy the predictions of a second civil war. I think Americans are better than that. If polls are to be believed, most oppose the way Trump has been implementing his immigration policies. Most don't accept his fascist police state. America may be tipping into that police state nonetheless, but we are also tipping into unity against it. We are moving into a solidarity that could give new meaning to the ideal of self-government, a system of, by, and for the people. I would like to believe the second tipping point will outlast the first. And that was by Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor, a professor of public policy emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. He is a Guardian U.S. columnist, and his newsletter is at robertreichsubstack.com. His new book, Coming Up Short, A Memoir of My America, is out now. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. Perhaps the major reason the disreputable Donald Trump was elected the current prez of the USA is that the majority of his electors do not wish the real harsh future of dissolution and distress humanity has by now its own design forced upon human civilization. Trump might seem the final effort to face these possible horrors in a reverse psychological, self-inflicted hammer to the head awakening to exactly how horrible it might really be. The city of Astoria commemorated George Washington's 264th birthday on 22 February 1996 by chopping down several cherry trees and lying about why. The trees graced the top of Coxcomb Hill, upon which is erected the illustrious Astoria Column, which was built by a railroad in the 1920s as a replica of the Roman Emperor Trajan's victory column, celebrating his defeat of the Bulgars. The Astoria Column, with its distinctive wraparound historical tattoos, is the city's most noted and noticeable monument. Much of 1995 was spent painstakingly restoring the column's most noted original and weather-deteriorated graffito artwork depicting the history of Yankee American excursion into the lower Columbia River and the establishment of Astoria in 1811. A group of big bucks sponsors of the restoration, most of whom lived in Portland, wanted the cherry trees removed because they blocked camera angles for a video they intended to film and market to attract tourism to Astoria. The city council of the time voted the trees be cut down, claiming they were old and diseased, which tree experts denied. Many Astoria citizens were upset at the loss of the trees, which were donated to the city by the local American Legion post in the 1970s in commemoration of local war dead. City council members attempted to quell local disgust and outrage by repeating their lies that the trees were just about ready to fall down and were a public hazard, but they were countered by local arborarians who said that although the cold, wet climate of the Pacific Northwest is not the best for cherry trees, the trees were yet healthy trees in their prime and with care could have lived another half century or more. Unlike George Washington, who famously claimed he could not tell a lie, Astoria's beloved cherry trees got the axe as a result of the deceitful elected officials.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.